Hello, and welcome back to my Carer Audio Talks. My name is Matthew McKenzie, editor of A Care in Mind online newspaper, bringing news on mental health developments in the UK and sometimes further afield. I also run several carer forums a month, specifically aimed at mental health carers, that being unpaid carers caring for someone of a mental illness. I'm also on some national steering groups, one being the Triangle of Care, and also involvement over at the Royal College of Nursing. And I'm involved in several mental health trusts around London. But what really matters most of all is that I am a carer, and if you are a carer listening, then that what counts. So we have something in common. Now, these audio files are designed to share my wisdom and experience with other mental health carers like myself. And the audio, as a reminder, is usually split into two sections, one being more educational, because I feel a lot of carers out there sometimes not so educated in how things occur in the mental health system and in social care. And to be honest, I wanted something that can reach other carers who cannot possibly always attend the groups that I might run or the forums that I might run. The second section of this audio, which I will perhaps warn when going on to the second section, is more therapeutic, and again, I feel a lot of unpaid carers perhaps do not get any uplifting or therapeutic engagement from other carer peer supporters. So my aim is just to inspire yourselves in order to continue on in your caring journey, or at least find some hope in that journey. Well, anyway, the topic for today, something that all carers, especially someone new to the caring journey, would have to deal with or should deal with, and that is dealing with professionals. I dare say health professionals, but on second thoughts, there's also other professionals unpaid carers have to deal with, because obviously the cared for is having to engage with them, or vice versa. So now, I don't want to go into all health professionals, to be honest. I'm just thinking off the top of my head. I think that will have to be for another audio, because to do this some service in this particular audio, I'm going to have to make it fairly long. I want to educate as much as I can, because as you know, the healthcare system and the social care systems, it's very complex and it's hard to navigate, especially for the carer who they need to talk to, and even how to engage or deal with them. But I think what I'll do is I'll mention, at least, you know, I have a little list here. I'll mention the important ones and the most common ones in you would need to deal with, at least. As mentioned before, I'll also throw other professionals in the mix, because they are very important if you're caring for someone with mental illness. And, you know, I feel like a bit of education, you know, you'd be surprised, as I mentioned before, by the amount of unpaid carers who, you know, who do not have much knowledge on who or what to talk to when being more involved in their loved one's care. And in the past, when perhaps you've asked a carer who they tend to regard as the health professional, it would often be their local GP or doctor. And yeah, that would be quite correct. But they are, as I mentioned, there's way more professionals carers need to engage with than just the doctor. And even though the doctor is the gateway to mental health services, there are other routes. So before I go into each role in some detail, I'll I've quickly mentioned the point of empowering yourself as a carer when dealing with professionals, and that very core of the message is you or any other unpaid carer cannot do all of this, and I'm specifically saying caring, by yourself. It is a challenging role, and I believe it is a role that is definitely not as supported as it should be. There is support, but I think it's a very complex and challenging role, specifically because healthcare systems, social care systems are not particularly suited to engage with families and carers, as I've experienced anyway. Obviously, someone out there has had a perfect or really good experience. I'm sure they can do an audio about that. But I think the majority of the carers, 7 million and counting, are struggling. And that's another reason why I'm doing the audio, to raise awareness of the caring journey and of what I consider a lot of struggles out there. Now, as mentioned before, you will need the help of the professional. But even then, still, there are hurdles and situations to get through, especially the C word. No, not cancer, but confidentiality. Now, as noted, if you have been a carer for a fairly long time, now certainly read through NHS Mental Health Trust's carer booklets and leaflets, since a good booklet that I think anyway will explain the roles of mental health staff. When you actually go to see a health professional about, you know, the situation of the cared for, you know, do not just go without being a little prepared. Think about the meeting and what type of meeting it is, and then come with those very questions. Certainly type them up or write them down, because you never know when you might need to refer to them. In fact, I would go further that if you've met the health professional before and you've jotted down some notes, then when you meet them again in another meeting, bring those notes with you, refer back to them to see what has progressed since the last meeting, what has been achieved and what hasn't. Plus, when seeing the health professional, you know, I agree, it might be a daunting meeting, it might be a little scary, because you're not sure what is expected of you. And I suppose the same can be said for the cared for, especially if they're not so well. Plus, you might not get your own way or your own view across. Still, use the opportunity to voice your opinions, or concerns, or even compliments during the meeting, and ask them if they can be recorded onto paper, onto the carer's file. No, it doesn't have to be audio, but it should be written down so it can be referred to at a later date. You might wish, if you want, bring someone with you to a meeting, perhaps a friend, or even another professional, an advocate. It depends what type of meeting it is. And going into the advocate role, I think a lot of mental health carers or carers do ask at the care centres if someone could accompany them to a meeting that they're not sure of, and they're probably a bit scared that a lot of the NHS jargon might be thrown back and forth. And that could be a way of, unfortunately, putting the carer off in understanding what on earth the meeting is going on about. Now, I'm going to have a little list here, and I'm afraid some of it is a bit by memory, but I'm going to list some of the roles that, as a carer, or as I feel carers should be interested, especially if you are a mental health carer, especially if you're caring for someone with mental illness or mental health needs. And as usual, because I don't want this audio to run too long, I'm going to be fairly brief on at least the common roles, because, you know, to be honest, I should really dedicate an audio on specific roles, especially social workers, care coordinators, psychiatrists, pharmacists, especially the local GP. So perhaps one day down the line, I'll do Pacific Audio in engaging or dealing with Pacific professional role. So our first one, and I think probably the most important, I suppose, is that being the first role, is a clinical psychologist. And now, you might often have access to them if you're cared for is in, let's say, in the secondary service, I suppose. Hence, they've been referred on or taken into a hospital mental health trust service. That could mean that they are quite unwell and have been quite unwell for some time, let's say a severe mental health illness. Usually, clinical psychologists tend to work in hospitals, community mental health teams out in the community, even in schools and prisons, and they usually often help diagnose the illness of the cared for. And they even help develop the mental health service. Again, another one similar is your psychiatrist, but they're more specialized obviously in mental health, and they're licensed to provide medication. If you care for has one, which they're fortunate because I don't think there's many that's going around, I think the numbers are dwindling, then you should be involved as much as you can, even if you're not invited to the meetings, and that's something you should raise. Usually, meetings with a psychiatrist would be, let's say, CPA care program approach meetings, I'm not sure, care planning meetings, or even medication reviews. Now, out of all the professions, it is so important to have a good working relationship with the psychiatrist. Obviously, it's not unknown for the kid for to request a different psychiatrist, and even carers can. And there's many reasons why this is the case, or why they prefer to continue a good working relationship with the psychiatrist. And perhaps I will dedicate a particular audio to that. Next, we have nurses. They have different bands, and higher the band, I would say the more knowledgeable and more specialized the nurse would be. So I'm not going to go into the bands yet. I don't fully know as much as yet, but let's go into them as general. Being that if your loved one is in the mental health system, they'll either end up perhaps on the mental health ward, or even if it's not mental health, it'd be the acute ward. It is important to find out, you know, what the nurse has been assigned to your cared for. In the acute ward, it might rotate. When I'm still caring for my loved one, obviously she was in the hospital, and I usually looked up on the hospital bed and noticed a different nurse was assigned, so I would speak to that nurse. And in the mental health ward, again, when you visit the ward, you'd look up on the board in the corridor and see who's assigned to your cared for. Obviously, it depends on the illness. And again, I will do an audio dedicated to hospitals and mental illness treatment, especially when it comes to mental health liaison nurses. And you see, it's getting a bit more complex now, but I will again try to shed some light on it. And they are, I think they're completely rare, to be honest. It's not easy to get hold of psychiatric liaison nurses, but they're crucial, since a lot of hospitals that I know now, due to my forums, are rushing to develop mental health and care strategies. But do not worry about that for now. If you're visiting your loved one on the ward in a mental health setting, certainly ask, and I want to remind you, certainly ask which nurse has been assigned, and definitely ask who is the carer lead, and that will be a nurse, who is the carer's lead on that ward, since they are the ones who are actually trained to deal with carers, and their role is also to help other staff on that ward identify unpaid carers. And again, I'm talking about mental health carers, but this again is spreading to other hospitals across the country. When engaging with a nurse on a mental health ward, you might want to get your views in regards to the cared for's care plan or discharge plan or both, and certainly get invited to ward rounds. Do not be scared to ask. You need to know, because who will the cared for be discharged to? And that is yourself if you are a carer caring for someone with mental health needs. So okay, on to the next role. And you know, I know it's a bit brief and there's a whole lot more to each of these roles so far, but I just want to go through the most common ones. And again, I will try and dedicate an audio to each role. Mental health counsellor, especially families, I suppose, for family therapy, right? Counsellors do a large range of therapeutic services in mental health. And often, you might wish to get family therapy. You know, I myself, unfortunately, have not had much of a good time with them. And a good reason is quite a few, I do feel, and I've discussed this with psychiatrists and psychologists, quite a few are fairly young, younger than me, and I get the feeling that they're almost telling you how to live and where you have gone wrong, not realizing the strain of the mental health services on the family. But anyway, if relations in the family break down, then it's worth trying to get access to such a service. Usually, they're placed in the community mental health teams. Now, if you find a good counsellor, and I mean a really good one, then it is worth it. You can find one actually at your carer centre. If you're really lucky, care centres do provide counselling as well. It might not be for the family therapy, but specifically aimed at the carer, because they're, as mentioned, their role can be really difficult. They can pick up a lot of trauma as well. And even better news, some of them, I think most of them, are actually quite free to use. But again, it depends how much funding the carer centre gets in order to continue on with therapy for unpaid carers. One quick word on finding a therapist or good counsellor for either you're cared for or for the family or for yourself. And I can't state this more importantly enough. If you are going to see one, be very choosy, because you may have to bear your soul to them. And that is very precious. Okay, the next role, again, fairly common, but I would say under a lot of strain, the way the systems has been run, I'm going to get political, the government has gotten rid of a lot of them. You know, when I went over to Parliament, there was a lengthy discussion on the importance of social workers. And this is something, this discussion is not going to go away anytime soon. Social workers can be assigned to support your cared for in the community, especially if the cared for is struggling in the community. Social workers can do the following up in, let's say, helping the cared for adjust to, major life changes, especially when they've been discharged or trying to recover from a serious relapse. They are also very skilled in responding to, let's say, crisis situations. They can help the service user connect the patient to very important resources. Again, there's not much out in the community, but they'll try their hardest to try and connect the service user to those resources and to forms of support. A good example is financial support. A lot of service users or patients suffer through financial hardship. Social workers can also provide a form of advocacy for the careful when needed. And usually one thing that I've noted throughout my long spell of caring for someone and continuing to care for them is that, I've noticed social workers can take the strain when the unpaid carer, especially the ones caring for you know, a close relative or someone in the family, is already, the carer is already having to do that and even more. But remember, when things go wrong, the thing is, the social worker can move on while the carer has to try and repair damage. Social workers can act as care coordinators, and I'll get onto that in the next, I think it's next on down the list, we'll discover a bit more as well. Sorry, that's just my phone. Right, care coordinators, what do they do? And again, not easy to get hold of one. Again, if your cared for has one, you're in a bit of luck unless they're not, you don't get on well with them. They vary in quality, but it is a specific role designed to help the cared for and the carer. Care coordinators do a huge amount. They are pivotal in helping the cared for in their recovery, if there is forms of recovery. And I'll put this one quickly. One thing that I am critical in Mental Health Trust's information is, especially to carers, is what the care coordinator does. And I will go into it. Basically, care, let's get into it anyway. The care coordinators are, again, usually assigned to the cared for. Using secondary service, you're not going to get them if the cared for cannot get past gatekeeping by the GP. Right, the amount of, the type of role, I suppose, care coordinator does, as I mentioned, is complex and very lengthy. I mean, they, similar to social workers, they coordinate in a crisis or in a relapse. They usually need to note down why it's happened, and the next steps, have to help plan with the carer and the cared for in recovering from that crisis. They have to work with the GPs and the pharmacists. So if you have the care coordinator, just definitely mention the name GP that you might take your cared for to, because often they will pick up things that the care coordinator might not know, that the GP might not know. They are trained in therapeutic intervention. And I've mentioned that when it comes to planning, they usually help develop and must also try and follow the care plan approach, or the care plan that is also produced by the psychiatrist. Usually, if you're trained in helping with financial support, or they would refer, similar with also housing support, or also referring to housing support, and they are trained, or supposed to be trained, to engage with other partners, that including yourself. Other things they do, if I'm going down a lower level, is that they tend to attend medical reviews to give their opinions on how the cared for is getting along. They do a lot of documentation in regards to, this is really critical, gathering and following up on physical health information. Remember the GP that I've mentioned before? Information from the doctors, test results, a whole big complex issues. If the cared for is using a lot of services, especially if given medication, there'll be, you know, diabetes tests, blood tests from urine, tests in regards to weight, things like that. They need access to those, because the medication that may be given to the cared for will, you know, have side effects. Hence, the care coordinator will be heavily trained in health education. And that is the health education where they're trying to educate the carer and also the cared for in regards to medication side effects, having a healthy lifestyle. And the big one, actually, right now amongst Mental Health Trusts is giving up smoking. They're also trained in, as I mentioned, health promotion services. Again, similar to getting aid to giving up smoking, giving up drinking if needed. definitely, if they're flexible enough, they'll definitely attend emergency appointments. In the past, I've had one or two rush off the feet and attend from one client to another in regards to emergency situations. One of the most important things that they need to take note of is monitoring the mental state of the cared for. So obviously, the longer you have a care coordinator, the better. Because a criticism I have with, again, modern mental health is that they tend to not stay in that role for so long. So the next person that comes along will tend to think that the cared for at that current state is how they act, when clearly the cared for is quite unwell and not how they were when they were on medication or perhaps in a better state of mind. Another thing that, and as you can see now, I'm describing a lot, this is only half of it. It's not even half of it, but a care coordinator would look for medication compliance in some sense. Is the medication being taken? Does it have the effect? They would monitor side effects, because obviously the carer might not fully know. I mean, how many medication, you know, again, I'll do an audio on it, but how much medication, antipsychotics, and more than what would the carer know about, specifically when you're looking at generations of medications. And they can also, care coordinators can also provide medication. Hence, they would, I've forgotten the word for it, give the medication to the cared for. It might be through, usually depots I've seen, like injecting medication, they'll do that safely. If they're from a nursing background and they can deal with prescriptions. So if you are a carer, or if you want to learn about carers, or and if you're caring for your loved one, I asked you, and I'll press this to other carers, is to find out what role the prescribed or the care coordinator has. They have many, far more than perhaps the psychiatrist, even though the psychiatrist is pivotal. And again, you should really be involved when it does come to care coordinators and social workers. You know, you should have some idea what is going on, and you should give your views to them. And, you know, to be fair, as I said, I'll dedicate an audio to that when the time comes. If there was something that is urgent in working with the care coordinators, again, please involve yourself and the cared for care plans, and let them, you know, ask your loved one if you can have a copy of that care plan, and certainly press that the cared for has a copy for themselves. Get them to read it and understand it as another ball game. But when I say a carer's journey or a cared for's journey, along that journey should be, let's say, a map. And that map is the care plan. Yeah, do not keep, this a last word on this, do not keep being persuaded that the patient needs to agree all the time that you should be involved. Unless maybe there's a safeguarding issue, then I'd understand. I think, again, there's a lot of pushback on carers needing to be involved. They should, because they're trying to care for the cared for, and if they can't, well, what do you expect? The cared for is going to be back in the ward. They're going to be back in the hospital. There's not enough beds for that. So, right, the ward pharmacist, very important, because if your loved one is on medication, you know, it's important that you have links to the ward pharmacist, or even a pharmacist. You have pharmacists outside the ward, especially if you need to understand the life changes of the side effects of the medication, especially, you know, I am caring for someone that has diabetes. So with all the strange and funny names on that medication, unfortunately, you must query what the side effects are, and there are a lot. You know, could it be tremors? Could it be problems sleeping or even oversleeping? Some medication just knocks the cared for out. Could it be drooling? Could we have the effect on, and this probably, I don't know if I can get this right, effect on white cells in the blood. I'm not sure. maybe is the dosage too high or is it too low? You know, a lot of things kids have to deal with is the right balance. Sometimes, you know, myself, I might sort of observe to see, is the medication even working? Now, medications, although they are an important tool in recovery, they are not the only tool, and you should ask pharmacists for advice in the medication and also be handed over leaflets. Again, remember I mentioned the C word, that can be an issue in dealing with medication, and you know, it's a reoccurring theme, unfortunately. Anyway, if the mental health trust, hence, you know, what's the word for it, a grouping of hospital services and services in the community has a ward pharmacist, and it should do, and perhaps not one in the community, it should be queried, and carers and family should have access to them. So okay, the next role, and I'm sorry this is a long audio, I'm really sorry for that, but it's really important, and if you don't understand what I'm getting at, please just play it again. Occupational therapists, very, very, very important, but I suppose can be expensive. As mentioned, medication, it's not the only tool in the box to deal or increase with the quality of life for the cared for, as occupational therapists provide, you know, education programs in regards to how the cared for can cope. They can do this, and I've seen them, they hold special, let's say, cared for groups or service user groups in community mental health teams, like treatment groups, either one-to-one or in groups, but usually it's in groups, and this helps the patient or service user have an idea of the mental health, mental illness, being self-aware, developing social skills, stress or depression management, role development. They also work with the cared for in regards to developing interests, developing things that they patients can develop in regards to, let's say, art. They use, you know, occupational therapists will use art to have patients express in other ways what they're going through, or a way of having art becoming, let's say, more of a healing factor in regards to the patient's journey through the mental health system, or the patient's journey through mental illness. This can also go, occupational therapists can also go to using music. Music, again, is a healing factor. It's not always medication. Other things occupational therapists can, I'm trying to think, is again that can help develop skills on independent living, especially linking in with community resources. A new term is social prescribing, and that is what GPs are now being asked to do. And again, this is something I'll cover in another audio. I've been in situations where occupational therapists will come to the home and help the cared for in managing living at home, managing and dealing with the home, managing medication, managing time, managing even getting the cared for to cook and being safe at home. And they'll help train and help the cared for look into activities in daily living that could be hygiene, that could be grooming. And again, as a carer, you may probably be involved, but this is just to help in the idea of independent living. In fact, under the Mental Health Trust, my local one, we have a service called, I think it's called SIRS, which is Social Inclusion and Recovery Service. And their aim is to help the cared for, the service user, explore their goals and ambitions. Because one thing you will notice with schizophrenia psychosis is that it has negative and positive effects. Now, positive effects, I think, they add to the mental illness, hence delusions, hearing voices, things like that. But the negative effects, and this is where the occupational therapist comes in, is that they take away, they make the patient less interested in linking to the community. They make the patient, they take away from the patient their social life, their friends, their interests, and thus the patient or the service user perhaps falls deeper into, you know, watching TV. That could be their life. Okay, what's the time? All right, a few more. Ward manager, not someone you're going to see often. They're usually busy rushing up and down behind a desk, supervising staff on the wards. Now, not all ward managers are alike, and I've learned this through my talk with the CQC when they visited and usually tend to revisit the forms of running the community for unpaid carers. Because when I asked about quality, they said, well, yes, the ward managers, if a ward is going to do well, it really rests on the ward manager's shoulders. If you do manage to speak to one on the ward, and I've spoken to plenty, and I still do speak to them, you could ask about ward rounds and when visiting the cared for in hospital. And it's worth asking if they could include you on things in the ward. Now, this is going a bit more than above than what I'm saying. When I say include the carer on the activities, that would mean that the carer has a chance and the power to influence how the ward is run, especially if the carer was complaining about something. A good thing is how hot it might be on the ward, or even complimenting. Now, again, I'm going to do a special audio on this. This might be more of involvement, but I have come into instances where wards, and it should have them, have carer surgeries on the wards or patient surgeries, and I've attended a few in the past. And that would look into, again, how the ward was run. So that way, patients are not in a situation where things are always done to them and they're always told what to do, but more like, let's see how we can work this thing out together, how we can work together, what activities are best suited for the patients. Okay, this is probably, the next one's probably the most common one. Excuse me. Admin for services. It doesn't make sense at the moment, but I think a lot of veteran carers will know what I mean. And but they would be like your receptionists at GP surgeries or at the community mental health teams, the ones that would face, you know, be the front line for carers or the cared for. And again, by the very title, they perform various admin duties. They're there to meet and greet the cared for. They are especially important for identifying carers. And they are good at referring to, you know, what is going on in the ward and referring to what is needed, you know, what is out there in the community for the cared for. For instance, a good example is at a GP surgery, I was given a carer's register form by the receptionist at that GP surgery. And if you're visiting your doctor's surgery, you certainly should ask for one. So you'd be registered at the doctor's surgery. A very important one, the doctor, the GP. Out of all the roles that I've mentioned, this health professional is very influential to the health of your loved one. In fact, even to the health of yourself if you're a carer. Now, no matter where you are in your caring journey, you should have access to a GP. And if possible, when an appointment is made, please try and attend with the cared for, with your cared for. Unfortunately, GPs tend to not know as much as on mental health. And it gets worse in when GPs sometimes, well, more often, may not understand the complex nature of mental health services because they keep changing them all the time. But I believe the newer GPs has been scoped to train them up on you know, mental illness and dealing with the cared for and dealing with the carer. As usual, please use the power of writing a letter to your GP if you are concerned about your loved one, because it gives the more information a doctor gets about the situation, the better the outcome and the more they can have options in how to provide support to yourselves. You know, so much, I think, when it comes to letters to GPs, usually gets placed into records Anyway, remember I've mentioned that the care coordinator or the social worker would, and you know, if they're very good, they would refer back to the GP in regards to information. Now, as soon as I think as a, you know, a really good GP identifies you as a carer, the easier it is to avoid the C word, that being the confidentiality trap, which can lock you out of providing support to your loved one. Now remember, if your GP is not helpful to yourself or your loved one, then it's okay to see another GP. I always say to carers, just change your doctor or GP to one that does understand your situation, that is more sympathetic to what the family or the cared for, the carer is going through. All right, the next lot is, and again, something really critical of in regards to NHS, peer specialists. You know, there are not many around as there used to be, you know, cuts, you know, austerity. Like, peer specialists are those with, let's say, lived experience. Hence, they've been through perhaps mental illness, or they've been through the carer journey, and they take the strain off the carer. But, you know, lived experience is, I'd say, not enough for, you know, a good peer supporter. Hence, I'd say, you know, like a peer support, a mental health peer support for the cared for must be really skilled in using their personal experiences to develop meaningful and trusting relationships with the patient or with the service user. As with myself, peer specialists act as a mentor. They're like, you know, when I said the care plan is a map to the recovery journey, or even if it isn't recovery, it's still a map. They, I would say, they're like a tour guide in that journey. So they've successfully managed their own recovery in some sense, and they still are. Man, you know, you wouldn't want a peer specialist who is not good at managing their own mental health, because how can they mentor the cared for in some ways? Although it can, it's not unknown for a peer specialist to become very unwell. That doesn't mean they're not very good. You know, mental illness can strike anyone at any time due to life situations. But obviously you'd want one. You want a peer specialist that have an idea of how the cared for can engage and manage with and identify with mental illness. Peer support specialists, they provide us, say, an example on how the cared for can move and face recovery. Usually you would find, let's say, peer supporters in a team where they usually, let's say, remember when I told you about the occupational therapist, you may have a peer supporter there helping to challenge mental health stigma, which can slow down recovery, unfortunately, as patients begin to shun mental health services because they can't cope. They can't cope with the identity of the illness, even though some service users may feel, oh, yes, someone's told me what the illness is, and I now know what it is, and I know how to cope with it, while others just do not want to face it, and usually peer supporters are then assigned to say, how can we challenge this? Okay, right. Peer supporters, they can encourage, as I said, can encourage engagement from family members and carers. I haven't seen a peer supporter that doesn't do that. They, you know, the aim is to encourage engagement. However, as I've mentioned before, there is a lack of peer supporters because, and unfortunately, I keep hearing not a lot of mental health trusts have them. They just don't have the money to employ really good ones. And the ones that I've seen are almost doing it for free because it's affected them, and they want to see a change in the community. They're that passionate about it. Now in the UK, I'm talking about now first sector charity organizations like Mind and Sane and Rethink Mental Health Foundation. Usually when they do a campaign, I usually see them push for more peer supporters, and you tend to find a lot of them at these branches. Okay, advocates, again, common in some aspect. There's several of them. You've got the ones that are really trained up. These would be your independent mental health advocates, actually, I don't think they're that common at all, to be honest. Usually what they do is this is where you're going to be coming into law, I suppose, mental health law. And they work within the framework of the Mental Health Act to represent and meet the needs of mental health patients. Especially, you'll find them on ward rounds, to be honest, especially when it comes to tribunals. Hence, a patient doesn't want to be on that ward anymore and they want to get out, and usually they ask for a tribunal. So they're more likely to represent your loved one, not just at that, but other things as well. And as I mentioned, they're skilled in understanding, let's say, the Mental Health Act of 1983. And they're more geared towards, let's say, representing and helping the patients or the service user know their rights in relation to the Mental Health Act. They're also skilled in explaining the conditions and restrictions that apply to the patient if they've been sectioned on the mental health ward. And they're also very aware of the medications and the treatment the patient is receiving, especially if the cared for is not happy with the medication. The advocate, or what you could say IMHA, stands for Independent Mental Health Advocate, will get involved. Now, they're pretty clued up on legal authority and, get, as I said, get an idea of medical treatment and also safeguards and other requirements of the Mental Health Act 1983. Now, I think you'd especially need them in the mental health team, because, and the reason is, this is really, really important what I'm going to mention here. Sometimes mental health teams can get a bit funny. And yes, abuses do happen. It is hard to expect mental health carers to understand the Mental Health Act, let alone the revamping of the Mental Health Act currently as of this audio recording, because a lot of patients, in fact, too many are being, I forgot the word, institutionalized, I would say, being brought back on the wards. And again, it's hard for carers to even understand the CARE Act 2014. A lot of IMHAs might not even get an idea of that. But if you think it's just the Mental Health Act, it's also the Equality Act 2010, the Mental Capacity Act 2005, the Human Rights Act 1998, the Data Protection Act, I think GDPR 2018. I'd expect a carer, an unpaid carer, to know these lengthy acts, these laws, and hence this is the importance of an IMHA. So yes, independent mental health advocates have a wealth of knowledge engaging with patients' rights. They don't have to be an IMHA, they could be advocates out in the community. I've seen them out in the community for 20 years, almost as knowledgeable or even more so than trust or IMHAs or independent ones. So if you can, and you should, as a carer, get an advocate or an IMHA for your loved one, it takes the strain off you. So I think, again, I'm going really long. I think what else can I fit in? How about PALS, patient advice liaisons, staff or team? Again, your most common form of engagement in regards to hospital admission or mental health trust services. Now, if things are not going well, then the patient advice and liaison team are there to at least follow up your requests or the cared for requests. And I don't expect the cared for to always make a complaint. I mean, they might do, I don't know. It doesn't have to be complaints. It could be compliments. It could be queries raised at hospitals. A good query I raised is when my loved one was discharged from hospital and it wasn't a mental health ward. She lost her care plan or something like that. Her discharge notes, that's what it was. And I asked the PALS to send that back in an envelope, deliver it to her, which they did. Other things is particular service. My loved one wasn't engaging with them, and I didn't have the note on who was meant to be engaging in regards to medication. And PALS chased this up for me and said, this is the person you would need to speak to. Now, again, PALS teams can be really funny. they don't all act the same. And I'm going back to the nature of my forum. Sometimes I will have to go through pals to find out who on earth in within a hospital service or within a hospital trust is doing what. And some will know straight away, while others haven't a clue. So it means that I have to do the legwork and find out who's responsible for a particular service in the health trust. So yes, they vary in quality, but again, I don't know how well they're trained. I don't know. My next one, I think I'll have to make this for the last one. There are many more, and I'll tell you why. But this is the last one, probably the most important, I suppose, is the solicitor. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to get political. This current government, as of this audio, has stripped away legal aid. And this is the time when the cared for needs them. Not just the cared for, but the carer needs them. But still, you can get support from a solicitor if your loved one is on the ward. They might not want free ones, I don't know. Again, they're varying quality. They definitely do. But again, it's not uncommon for the cared for to request a solicitor at a tribunal. And that means getting their voices heard when they are sectioned or dealing with powers of attorney, that be the carer, might need assistance and things like that. And I will come to that in another audio. Especially when the cared for, what I'm saying is if the cared for begins to, let's say, lose capacity in the future or plan for the future when capacity is lost. So the solicitor can grant the carer, let's say, the right to make decisions. Or they can grant the cared for, let's say, the right to make an informed and planned decision. However, those decisions can still be overruled by the mental health team, especially on in regards to medication. Now, as I said, solicitor services under mental health, especially if the kid falls on the ward, they're usually free. But at times, legal aid, as I mentioned before, can be very costly and depends on the kid's force financial situation. Now, going away from that, there are many more roles a carer needs to take into consideration. For example, one trust that I know of, I think it's Central Northwest London Trust, they have more than 7,000 staff. So it's not to say that you're going to be dealing with all of them. There's no way, but it just goes to show how complex the mental health system can be to navigate when it comes to dealing with professionals, especially for the cared for. I expect them to know. Anyway, as I said, one day I will dedicate an audio for a particular role on health professionals. So anyway, if you're a carer, just to wrap this up, if you're a carer listening to this audio, please continue to find thought and reflection on dealing with the professional. Starting in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. It has been a long audio, and I'm sorry for that. But I would like to thank you for getting this far. I know being a carer, being a person that cares and is, through providing care, a lot is asked of you, and due to the nature of this audio, a lot more will be asked of you. The way the health and social care system works is that they will always have more people, they will always have more resources than you, and you have to try to deal with that. But unfortunately, what if those very resources, those professionals, do not understand your situation? What if those resources and those professionals begin to assume things? Hence, what if bureaucracy kicks in? As with many things in the world of the professional, all the definitions of the professionals are there to help us. They're there to help you and the person you care for. But what if somehow that very structure turns against you? What if they are pressured, and I'm talking about the professionals, if they are pressured by policies to make quick decisions that affect not only your life, but the very future, as if you are just a tool to them, hence a tool to the professional? What if those very professionals do not even have the time for you, or assume that you are in the way? And don't get me wrong, that does happen. Think of it. Most, if not all, the experts I have mentioned focus most of their time on the patient, on the person that you care for, because the patient, by definition, is unwell mentally or physically. But the carer, that being yourself, is just a witness, a bystander, waiting for things to get better in time. If there is anything to come out of this audio, I urge you to link into those professionals, link with them. Recognize what they can do for you and you're cared for. And if they are not doing it, then realize it. As a carer, you will need to deal with them, work with them, because you cannot do it on your own. Do not expect someone who is very unwell to do all the legwork, because, you know, it might mean empowerment to someone to use that resource well from a service user's view, of course. But think about it. The way the health and social care system is, I would not count on it. You will have to understand how it works. Get support on how it works. Look for NHS patient and carer booklets on how professionals work, because you and the cared for depends on that information, depends on that relationship and the work the professionals do. Now, I have been there, my friend, I'm telling you, and I will continue to do so. Now, I've been through the situation where I've been blamed for being too involved, trying to run someone's life, meddling, sticking my nose in, complaining too much, bullying, and being troublesome. Well, what would you expect? What would you expect when life throws you into a situation where you have to stand by watch someone you love deteriorate? Watch someone you love slowly losing physical and mental health. Someone you love lose their friends, independence, meaning of life. I'm sure you would do the same, right? Thank you for listening to my audio, and I hope to see you again soon. Again, sometimes, because I'm sometimes doing this from memory, you might have to replay it to try and get an idea, but I'm hoping, because I can't reach every carer, perhaps this is a resource mental health carers or carers can use to aid them in the caring journey. Thank you for getting this far, and I'll see you again, or I'll speak to you again soon. Take care, and good luck on your caring journey.